Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Her Half of History, an Evergreen podcast. My name is Lori. The current series is The Last Queen, and The Queen Who Comes Next caused me no end of trouble. There is so much written about her, much of it contradictory, that I just could not squeeze her story down into a single episode, not even with liberal use of the backspace button. So this is the first of three episodes on a woman many hoped would be the last queen of France. This is episode 12.9, Marie Antoinette, The Luckiest Princess. You know how first-time parents take lots of pictures and document all the milestones and cute moments? But with child number two, they are busier and it's not new anymore, so they document less? And still less than that for child number three, not to mention number four and number five? Well, imagine being child number 15. Yes, that's right. Maria Theresa was the Empress Regnant of the Habsburg Empire, based in what is now Austria. In her spare time, she gave birth 16 times within 19 years. Clearly, this is a woman who needs her own episode. But for today, the point is that the 15th child was Maria Antonia, born November 2nd, 1755, and that's about as much as we know about her early childhood. Princess though she was, childhood wasn't yet a particularly celebrated stage of life, and it's not like there weren't a gaggle of other princesses, so we get no hard details. It is true that a child prodigy named Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart visited her palace when she was seven, and so was he, more or less. But the anecdote that they met and that he declared he would marry her someday is probably not true. What we do know is that the value of having a lot of girls in a royal family is that you can then marry them off in politically advantageous ways. And the political advantage Maria Theresa most wanted was an alliance with France. Traditionally, France and Austria were not friends. Far from it. But Maria Theresa pressed long and hard about changing that. There was some doubt about who exactly should be offered up as a sacrifice to achieve this goal. The doubt existed on both sides. On the Austrian side, they were spoiled for choice. A handful of princesses were still unmarried. Any of them would have satisfied their mother's plans. It really didn't matter. On the French side, there was an old king called Louis XV, and his wife was dead, so that put him back on the dating market. There was the crown prince, always called by his title the Dauphin, even when writing in English. The Dauphin was not Louis XV's son, who had died, but his grandson, still a boy, but we don't really have a minimum age on the dating app either, so that put him on the market. Either the king or the Dauphin would have been an acceptable groom. Princess Maria Elizabeth, child number 6, was proposed as a bride for Louis XV. The 33-year age difference between them was no problem. The fact that he had a string of high-profile, utterly unconcealed mistresses was also no biggie. And when I say unconcealed, I mean it. The king's mistress was an official position. It came with its own staff. The proposal actually got scotched on the French side. Maria Elizabeth had been famed for her beauty, but then smallpox. The girl survived, her beauty did not. And when this was reported to Louis, he decided he liked being a bachelor, after all. Instead, Louis XV agreed that the Dauphin would wed. Not Maria Elizabeth, no pockmarks in France, please. But one of the younger daughters of Maria Theresa would do. As a side note, Maria Elizabeth never did find a man who could look past her ravaged face. She was sent to a convent instead, crying all the way. She did not live a monastic lifestyle, but entertained a lot and traveled. Given what later happened in France, I think she got the better end of the deal. but I doubt that it felt like it at the time. Anyway, that was how Maria Antonia became the luckiest of all the princesses, with a match that not one of her older sisters could rival, for the French court was the wealthiest, the most prestigious, the most glittering in all of Europe. It was the cultural and intellectual capital of the continent, and she was to become its next queen. She was 13 years old. Think of the 13-year-olds you know. Are they ready for marriage? Ready for permanent emigration away from their family? Ready to be showered with wealth, adulation, and power over other people's lives? Yeah, Marie Antoinette wasn't ready either, and everybody knew it. Maria Theresa hastily engaged tutors in music, art, and ballet. One wonders why she had not already done so, but I can't allow that the Empress was a busy woman, with other things and other daughters to think about. The French court sent their own tutor, because they clearly didn't think the Viennese court could handle it, and they were right. We have a dozen surviving letters from this tutor, and he says that Marie Antoinette spoke French of a sort. Her handwriting was inconceivably slow. Her spelling was appalling. He judged that she was quick on the uptake, but she was bad on the retention. He felt that she was capable of learning, if only she weren't so distracted. It is partially this tutor's comments that have led some modern writers to suggest that Marie Antoinette had ADHD. That could be, but a diagnosis at this distance is impossible, and it occurs to me to wonder how much experience the tutor had with children. I poked around a little into his background, but it was a question I was unable to answer. If he didn't have much experience, I think it's possible that his expectations were unreasonable for a 13-year-old. Besides all the lessons, there were the questions of physical appearance. She was pock-free, I presume, but what about her posture? And her figure? And her hair? And her wardrobe? And her teeth? Yes, it turns out that the history of modern orthodontics does begin in 18th century France, and Marie Antoinette's teeth were not good enough for the French court. All the sources on her left me discreetly in the dark about how exactly the straightening was accomplished, but contemporary manuals for dentists do exist. In them, the father of modern dentistry calmly explains how he operated on a patient every day for 2 months with the help of wires and a silver blade. And at the end of it, voila, all the teeth that were out of alignment are now, quote, as beautiful and good as they were previously deformed and bad, end quote. When you consider that modern orthodontics has anesthesia and spends a lot longer than 2 months accomplishing the same thing, yeesh! This sounds like excruciating agony, but there we are. Beauty hurts. A few months and an enormous amount of money was all her teeth, her French, and her deportment were going to get because Marie Antoinette was now age 14 and it was wedding time, ready or not. She was married in Vienna on April 19, 1770. Her groom didn't show, but then again, he wasn't expected to. Her brother filled in as proxy during the service. Then there were 2 days of outrageously expensive partying before she began her one-way journey into France. If there were few sources about her childhood as 15th child of the Empress, well, now she is the Dauphine of France. And from this point on, we are drowning in sources. She wrote plenty of correspondence herself. People also wrote letters to her. The people around her wrote letters to each other behind her back. The press wrote about her. Her lady-in-waiting wrote a memoir about her. Her friend, the Princess Lamballe, wrote a memoir about her. Her painter wrote a memoir, which I have previously referenced on this podcast, episode 10.7, Elizabeth Vigée-Lebrun. Even her hairdresser and her executioner wrote memoirs. I hope that wasn't a spoiler for you. Yes, we are headed towards an execution, but we won't get there this week. Every one of these people wrote with their own agenda top of mind. Historical accuracy was never the agenda. The accounts conflict as people fabricated, or embellished, or neglected to mention, or reported gossip as fact, or just flat out lied. It's bewildering and sometimes impossible to sort out from this distance. The court that Marie Antoinette moved into was a complicated one. In many countries, the nobility are dispersed around the country, each on their individual estates, only coming together on occasion. Not so in France. Louis XIV, the long-lived Sun King, had encouraged all nobles to come to Versailles on a permanent basis where he could keep an eye on them. And now, near the end of the long-lived Louis XV's reign, those nobles' descendants were all still there. Sure, the royal family kept an eye on the nobles, but the nobles also kept an eye on the royal family. Literally every moment of Marie Antoinette's day was regimented by 100 years of long-standing etiquette and accompanied by a crowd of onlookers, some of whom had official and paid positions which permitted them to help her with this or that small task. Marie Antoinette wrote to her mother that in the mornings, "I put on my rouge and wash my hands before everybody, after which the men go out and the ladies remain, and I dress myself before them." This level of scrutiny and adulation is not ideal for your average 14-year-old. And adulation isn't even quite the right word. All these people wanted something from her too, whether it was the promise of future favors, a better court position, or her support for them in their own intrigue against another member of court. And there were intrigues aplenty.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II. And people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, listeners. If you would like Her Half of History better without the ads, I hear you. Into History is a podcast subscription channel made by history lovers for history lovers. So you can get not just my podcast ad-free, but also History Daily, Wild West Extravaganza, Cold War Conversations, and more. Depending on your level of membership, Into History members and also Patreon supporters get access to more or less monthly bonus episodes on side topics. For example, if you've read ahead in the history of Marie Antoinette, you may be aware that she never actually ruled France. Her husband did that. Bonus episode 12.C is Why France Never Had a Queen Regnant, Not Even One. It's currently available ad-free on Into History or on Patreon. Please consider checking it out through links on my website or the show notes of this episode. If you've already done so, you are the best. Now back to the show. The most serious intrigue revolved around Madame du Barry, the old king's current mistress. Innocent little Marie Antoinette did not initially understand du Barry's role at court, but soon enough the cold facts were explained to her. Madame du Barry was a low-born, illegitimate former prostitute and street vendor who caught the eye of the king. There was etiquette and protocol even for mistresses, and she didn't measure up because she didn't have a title. So some small count had been rustled up from the backwaters and ordered to marry her. Now that she was a countess, she was qualified to be the king's official mistress, and protocol was happy even if a lot of other people weren't. Chief among the unhappy people were the three adult daughters of the king. Historians in general are not kind to these women, calling them prudes and self-righteous. But just think about it. Three single women who still lived at home because moving out was never one of their options. Their mom dies and dad takes up with a floozy more than 30 years his junior. She is clearly there for whatever she can get out of him. Of course they didn't like her. Marie Antoinette had been told by her mother to take her social cues from these three women, who were the highest ranking women in the court, and Marie Antoinette obediently did. She followed their lead in refusing to acknowledge Madame du Barry's existence. Not a word, not a nod. It was like the floozy was both invisible and inaudible. But soon Maria Theresa and the Austrian ambassador were begging her to do differently because France and Austria were currently divvying up Poland between them, and Louis XV was a lot more interested in the happiness of his mistress than he was in Poland. So long as du Barry felt slighted, he would sign nothing. And Maria Theresa was exasperatedly writing to her daughter, "Would it hurt you to just say hello to the woman?" And finally, Marie Antoinette did. On January 1st, 1772, she said, "There are a lot of people at Versailles today." An utterly banal sentence, but it was acknowledgement, so Madame du Barry was happy, so the king was happy, so he agreed Austria could have the best piece of Poland, and so Maria Theresa was happy. Presumably the Poles were not, but they were going to lose either way. Really, the whole episode gives me flashbacks to middle school social interactions, only way worse, because the stakes were astronomically higher and there was no expectation that anyone was ever going to grow up. This is just one of many examples of what counted as good governance in Europe's most glittering court. Obviously, what France needed was a younger, bolder, and more dynamic king. One who would inspire, lead, command loyalty, and encourage people's better natures rather than their worst instincts. One who wanted to actually govern and improve people's lives. So let's take a look at the Dauphin, husband of Marie Antoinette, about whom I have thus far said almost nothing, because he deserves his own explanation. Louis Auguste was born 1 year before his bride, in 1754. No one expected him to inherit the throne. Not only was it expected to go to his father, but even after that it was expected to go to his older brother, who was handsome and charming and everything one could want in a young prince. Louis Auguste, the younger brother, was sickly, awkward, and gangly. His older brother outshone him and bullied him. Even his younger brother outshone him in many ways. Louis Auguste's behavior baffled and irritated the people around him. For example, his aunt tried to make him comfortable by telling him that in her rooms it was just fine to talk, yell, make noise, break things, whatever. In other words, be a normal child. But he didn't. With his tutor, Louis was great at facts and figures. Geography and physics he loved. He could conjugate verbs in a half dozen languages. He also enjoyed locksmithing. One can imagine that in a different world, he could have had an excellent career in any of those fields. But being king is not about facts and figures. It's about people and relationships and force of personality, none of which work according to an equation or a timetable. In these areas, Louis was quite remarkably lacking. At the age of 11, he wrote and published a meticulous pamphlet describing the forest of Compiègne. It is remarkably accurate with regard to acreages and physical structures. It has not one word regarding beauty, color, pleasure in the scene, personal judgment, or any thought beyond the strict facts. His diary, which he kept throughout his life, is much the same. More than half of the entries contain nothing beyond what he killed in the hunt that day. When he did have another event he deemed worth recording, the entries are totally devoid of emotion. For example, on March 13th, 1767, his record says, "Death of my mother at 8 in the evening." One gets the sense that a dental hygiene appointment would be recorded in exactly the same way. Nothing changes as he grows older. Each entry is as bland as the last one, with the entry for July 14th, 1789, perhaps taking the prize for startling obtuseness. That was the day revolutionaries stormed the Bastille, now celebrated as a French holiday every year. It was absolutely momentous from every angle. Louis' diary says, "Rien," which means nothing. As in, he didn't shoot anything that day, and he didn't think it worth writing about anything else that may have happened. Throughout his life, Louis Auguste would demonstrate an astonishing ability to compile all the facts and figures to explain why France should take a particular course, only to have someone with less knowledge and more personality talk him into doing the exact opposite. One modern author has suggested that he had autism. Again, it's impossible to diagnose at this distance, but certainly social skills were not his gift. And it is all the more heartbreaking to realize that he was trying. His school notebooks contain an essay which he titled, "Concerning My Faults." It begins, "My greatest fault is a sluggishness of mind, which makes all my mental efforts wearisome and painful. I want absolutely to conquer this defect, and after I have done so, as I hope to, I shall apply myself without respite to uprooting all the others which have been pointed out to me." End quote. Not much later, he welcomed Marie Antoinette to France as his bride. His diary entry for the day he met her says, interview with Madame the Dauphine. So when you realize that we have a severely inhibited 15-year-old groom, a terrified 14-year-old bride, neither of whom had any choice about this marriage whatsoever, it is perhaps not surprising that the wedding night was less than blissful. We don't have any first-hand accounts, obviously, but the entire court noted that Louis got up early next morning and went hunting as usual. He showed no further interest in his bride. That gave rise to lots of public press openly speculating about the Dauphin's sexual prowess, or lack thereof, which cannot have helped his confidence levels at all. Some historians also call Marie Antoinette frigid and put blame on her. Frigid is a word at which I am inclined to be annoyed. She was very young, very scared, very overwhelmed by all the attention, and as baffled as everyone else by Louis's antisocial behavior. How much can you really expect from her? Add to all that, she may well have felt insulted. An enormous amount of time and money, and let's not forget the excruciating personal agony, had been poured into making her the loveliest and most desirable woman in the world. And yet, her Prince Charming was unmoved. He was to remain unmoved. It was not long before her mother began sending letter after letter asking why she wasn't pregnant yet. Marie Antoinette's education may have been rushed, but she certainly knew enough history to remember that an unconsummated marriage is easy to annul. A childless wife is medium easy to repudiate. And repudiation is for those who get lucky. The wives of Henry VIII of England offered plenty of instructive examples, and they are merely the most famous examples, not the only examples. If Marie Antoinette forgot any of these moral lessons, her mother was happy to remind her. As was the Austrian ambassador. Honestly, what did she think they had sent her into France for? She would be no good to Austria at all if she got sent back home, with or without her head. Let's just imagine Marie Antoinette's confidence levels after all this and think about whether you think frigid is the most appropriate word. If you want to assign blame, there is further proof, in a negative way, that it wasn't her fault. The proof lies in the fact that your average young prince, no matter how charming he isn't, generally has no trouble finding willing partners of whatever variety he prefers. Versailles was a large community of people with virtually nothing to do except conduct extramarital affairs, spy on their neighbors' extramarital affairs, and gossip. Maybe I'm being a little over harsh here, but not a lot. Louis had no shortage of role models to show him how to betray his marriage vows, and no shortage of people who would have been eager to report on it if he had. Yet he does not seem to have done so, not with any gender, not at any time. There is no record of a mistress at all, not even a one-night fling. It is generally believed that both bride and groom were still virginal 4 years after the wedding when the old king died of smallpox. Louis was now 19. Marie Antoinette was 18. She is said to have said in a stricken voice, "But we are too young to govern," which was probably the most gentle way of saying what everyone else was also thinking. My major sources for today are John Hardman's biographies, one on Marie Antoinette and one on Louis XVI. Check out the website herhalfofhistory.com for all the other sources, plus a transcript and a lot of gorgeous pictures, because let me tell you, this woman had her picture painted a lot. While you're there, please consider supporting the show in any way you can, whether it's a one-time donation or a small amount each month. Those who have done so already are my heroes. Next week, the luckiest princess will find out what it's like to be queen of the most glittering court in Europe. Don't miss it. Thanks.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts, and remember, don't believe everything you read.